if you wind up with something that has, let's say, a permeability of 30, like for an inductor, like a nickel nickel iron type of core type of thing, and there again, it's not so much the position around the core, but the positioning between the wire and its the center of the material to the wire. So in other words, like if you had the turns with the ferrite material or the core material centered in the center of the turns, as opposed to like offset to the turns, there may be a difference. Casey, too, do you like that?
Question. Go ahead, Matt Wesley. Yeah, Glenn, I have a question for you. Okay. I was kind of surprised what kind of power the new magnet motor has when it's digging into the ferrite material. Now, you said something that the cross section could be provided by the manufacturer. I'm playing with the three different sizes of the material, Russian made, very well Russian made. And the reason for it is that in community of free energy research, there is a common, and there are plenty of professors over there, a common statement that the American-made ferrite materials are alternated for some unknown reason. So we're playing with the either Chinese or we're playing with the Russian-made. Take me up. Okay, now, if you play with the neodymium magnet motor, neodymium magnet, around the ferrite, can you do permanent change to that ferrite core material?
Well, most of the properties of a magnetic core are mechanical. The cross-sectional area, you get out a caliper, you measure the length times the width of the, you know, the cross-section, and that's a fixed number. I mean, unless you start chipping away material, the cross AE or cross-sectional area is pretty much the same. If you look at a toroid, the path length is the center of the material. So in other words, like of that donut, not the center hole, but it's the outer diameter minus the inner diameter, right? Then you take the average of that, and it's actually that's the path length of a toroid. So that is there again, that's another mechanical measurement. It doesn't really change that much unless you crack it or gap it or do something to the material. Now the materials themselves, as long as the binders are good and they hold nice and steady, and they're usually pretty good. Most of the modern materials today are pretty well manufactured. So I would say that most geomagnetic materials are pretty solid, you know, especially the stuff commercially sold around the world. And just another comment about materials. Most of the materials used in modern transformers today, whether it's Philips, TDK, some of the other Chinese manufactured things, most of everybody around the world is using the same stuff, Wesley, so I don't really know of any difference. Like there's some, you know, special Russian material that's any different than anybody else is using in KC2QIQ.
And Christian. I was very much surprised a few times with what Russians could do. And what reason they do. It's just sometimes incredible discovering the simple things that were made for a purpose. That's the only comment that I have in here. And to actually.
Mr. Civic, I can't remember his first name right now. W2CMI, I think it's called it as well. He had a whole series of articles in QST Magazine. Was that you, Mel? Correct me on his call letters and name.
Jerry Civic, W2, Fox, Mary, India.
Good old Jerry Civic. I was on the same day as with him. Boy, am I forgetful. You've only got to give me that information once every 2 weeks, Mel. Okay, W2FMI had a series of articles, Glenn, on electrically small antennas, ground plane type things, and he was doing fancy impedance matching with toroids. And there are certain kinds of toroid materials where there was a power level above which you're not supposed to go for the way it was being used. And he experimentally went above those power levels where the material did become artificially heated with the RF. And he experienced permanent damage, permanent change in permeability and other properties of the material when they were misused in that manner. Any guess as to what was going on there, what kind of material, what kind of change? I do remember him telling us, for this particular toroid, don't go above 150 watts or you'll permanently damage it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, I don't think you're going to find a problem with ferrite. Most of your ferrites are not going to have that problem. But where you can have the problems is stuff called powdered iron cores. And there's a company here in the United States called Micrometals. They make them. But, you know, there again, that's just the U.S. brand X. You know, I mean, there's Chinese manufacturers, Russian manufacturers. They don't make the same stuff. But there was a Type 52 material. And what they warned was that basically the material had an aging problem with the binder. And that if you ran, the flux levels too high, now that could either be done with, a frequency heating, or it could be done with running a B field at a low frequency too high. You can cause a binder failure. So typically, powdered iron inductors operated in high B fields, yeah, you can damage the binder. KC2QIQ.
So what was really happening there? Was the binder being cooked and therefore creating bubbles inside or rotting and flaking away? Why was Jerry measuring such a change just because the binder got cooked? Make a guess on that one, Glenn.
Well, from many of the articles that I read from Micrometals, what they were experiencing was that the binder itself would start to decay. Not the iron, but what would happen was the iron was getting repositioned, and what it was doing was increasing the loss tangent because the alignment of the iron itself was basically causing it would make it operate like a lower frequency material, and a much more lossy material. So it's basically the positioning of the iron with respect to the space. In other words, consider the binder as an air gap. So in other words, what they're really doing there is they're grinding up the iron, and you're very, very carefully spacing these iron pieces inside like a dielectric in space very, very evenly in this mix, and then they freeze it with high pressure and temperature. Let me let it drop for a second. Now, the problem is if the binder starts to fail, you're going to get shorting out of the iron, you know, in certain spots, and it'll become unruly. Like some areas you'll get shorting, other areas you'll get more air gaps, so you get air gap in one section, shorts in the other section as you're going along, and now you got a really non-uniform material, and really rotten things happen, and basically that all turns up in terms of loss and heating. KC2QIQ.
The temperature is high at this point, right?
KEY, why would it come in?
Glenn first, and then Mel. Go ahead, Glenn.
Basically, yes, high loss in the material basically adds to more heating, and then it's runaway. In other words, the more heating you get, the worse the problem gets, the more the binder breaks down, and more loss, until eventually the whole thing is just junk. KC2QQ.
Okay, have you run into this, Mel? And if so, where, and what did you see? You got it, Mel.
I've seen a number of these toroids that were blown up in tuners. People show me where they really crack the core up pretty good. But basically, I want you to look at something very interesting. Toroid permeability meter, homebrew construction job, June 1977 of ham radio. If you could bring that up, I'd love you to take a look at that and see what do you think about making this kind of contraption to measure the permeability of a toroid, Dick, over.
Did you get that on the QST or ARRL archives? Is that how you brought it up, or you went and got that issue?
KC2QIQ with a comment?
Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
I have a bunch of notes, you know, a ton of notes in my little book. Interesting project. On the interesting project, I not built this thing, but it looks like it's very promising, Dick, over.
Gmail, you need a hobby. Go ahead, Glenn.
Remember before I was saying that the ferrites, unlike the powdered irons, don't have a lot of the problems that the powdered iron has with the aging of the binder and that sort of thing, where the ferrites are much better. But you can still damage ferrite. Now, how can you do that? By really overheating it. If you go beyond curie by 2 to 1, now let's say that material's got a 200 degrees C Curie temperature, which is kind of low for a power material. But let's say you brought it to 400 degrees C. Now, how can that happen? Let's say you've got a balun up on the end of your antenna or part of an antenna tuner coupling network, and the VSWR is operated in a real off-center kind of way, and you've got an awful lot of lost tangent inside that balun or coupling device, you could wind up with something in there that will glow cherry red and will literally snap the ferrite because you just, you know, really superheated it. That can happen, KC2QIQ.
Sounds like once you run into that kind of power level and the loss starts increasing, you get a runaway condition. I'm getting the impression that powdered iron type magnetic materials is a real art form to properly forming them. That mixture has to be the right size particles, the right spacing between them, the right kind of a binder. And as you overheat them and that binder starts flowing, and those particles either come together, touch each other, give short circuits, or separate more than they were before, you disturb that carefully done art form in the manufacturing process, and you no longer have the same material. That's the impression I'm getting. I'm having trouble believing that the individual iron particles of powdered iron are themselves being changed. But maybe you've got an opinion on that one, Glenn. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, Dick, I think as the old saying goes, iron is iron. It's very hard to change that. But if a binder breaks down and they start shorting out and other things, you can see how the properties there can change pretty rapidly. But actually, the iron itself changing, I would like to see it. I mean, I don't know how it could, but, here again, that's just my experience would tell me the iron itself really doesn't change. But here again, you know, there's so many different materials out there. Keep in mind, you know, I would never use iron, powdered iron, in RF circuits. I mean, ferrite is great. I mean, there's ferrite you can do much more with. There's also, you can use other hybrid materials like molypermalloy. That's nickel metal. And that you can really do some interesting things with that and operate at much, much higher flux levels. So there's a lot of alternatives. Most of the time I'm going to use powdered iron or nickel metal type stuff is typically for inductors. But when I'm going to do transformers or coupling circuits, usually ferrite, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a question.
And so do I. I'm going to ask my first and pass it over to you, Wesley, and that is, Glenn, what do I do to the powdered iron particles that I've just gotten out of my grinding machine? Is there some way I can convert them into ferrite? What's the real difference between ferrite and powdered iron? Over to you, Glenn.
One is suspended in a ceramic, and the other one, the binder is completely different. It's really the binder, Dick. If you look at the binder materials and how these things are, electrostatically and chemically spaced, if you go to most of these manufacturers and you ask them how they do it, these recipes are really, really hard to come by. They try to keep that stuff underneath their hat like it's a national secret, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I take my powdered iron substance. I put it in this fancy proprietary binder, and I now have ferrite. Is that proprietary binder itself a magnetic material, or is it just some kind of very exotic epoxy-like binder? Over to you, Glenn.
From my understanding, Dick, the epoxy-type binders are more used with, like, the DC inductor types, which are like your powdered irons and the molypermalloys, which are, the nickel metals and the zincs and the other ones. The ferrites are more like iron, zinc, manganese, and ceramic. Very, very little plastics in there, and they just basically have a process where by chemically mixing these metals and this ceramic material, they get just the right spacing of the iron to these other metals to set up the ions in such a way that under high pressure, these things space themselves perfectly under the right pressures and temperatures. And to actually find out what those pressures, temperatures are, and the exact metals mix, they give you a hint to it, but they'll never tell you what it is exactly. KC2QIQ.
Sounds like there's a lot of art there. You got it, Mel. Wesley?
Yeah, thanks. If you guys turn to Wikipedia and put space vector modulation, space vector modulation. When I was looking at all of these frequency drives and trying to find out the problems of, about it. I went, actually I get accidentally to that, and what it says in here is a letter written for the consult post with modulation, and it is used to, for creation of alternating current, AC waveform, most commonly to three-phase AC power motors. I wonder if you and Glenn, maybe Eric, would be able to add something to that for others to understand, and also including me, and to exam.
Then I have a different question for you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm looking at space vector modulation right now. I wonder if you had a chance to see that one, Glenn.
Was this sent as an email?
I just put space vector modulation plus wiki as a search word in my search engine, and out came this wiki site called space vector modulation.
Okay, give me a couple minutes.
This is K2KEY, Dick. I want to ask you a question.
Go ahead.
Do you have any way of bringing up this ham radio June 1977? I'd really like to take a look at this thing. I really wonder if this thing really could work, and is it worth the effort over?
Okay. Yes, I do have, if it is archived on ARRL, and I being a life member, they give me access to most of those archives, and I think they've archived most of ham radio. I'm a long subscriber to ham radio, but I'll have a devil of a time finding those issues. I didn't store them in a very logical manner, so I'll give it a try right now.
You'll have no access.
How come?
This is WA2EGT. I'm also a life member. They only have QST available. It's a wonderful thing. I get hooked on it. But you must purchase the CDs that have ham radio archived on them. It's a matter of making money. Over.
Okay. Thank you for the information. Looks like I don't have access to it, Mel. You'll have to describe it to us. Maybe we can make a guess on that.
Okay. It basically shows a metal cup. Was made from, actually used an old Felsen case cup, and in the bottom he's got a known toroid, and inside this case with two contacts coming out of it, and then inside the case has a he puts in the unknown toroid, and through a number of tests, which are very simple, it determines the without winding any turns or anything, you determine the permeability of the unknown toroid, over.
There's lots of ways from the outside, without putting turns, you can put a magnetic field tangentially across the radius, so to speak, or across the diameter of a toroid and make some judgment. But I don't think that's as accurate as really exciting the real magnetic field in the toroid with turns of wire. By putting a toroid in a cup, I'm guessing you might not be able to excite the most desirable mode of the toroid. That's my guess. What's your guess on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Here again, you caught me off guard. I'm sorry, just Dick, if you could just repeat it again.
This ham radio article that Mel is describing, they have you put the toroid into a metallic cup and excited in some kind of a way with no turns of wire on the toroid. And yet they make a judgment as to the permeability of the toroid material. I'm a bit skeptical. I mean, there's various ways that I can excite a toroid where I'm putting a magnetic field in a diameter manner. In other words, from the 12 o'clock position toward the 6 o'clock position is a magnetic field. I'm going crosswise across the toroid material, as opposed to in the toroid ring itself. Without putting turns of wire on the toroid, I'm having trouble believing that this measurement procedure is going to come up with the right permeability for that material. What do you think about that one, Glenn?
Well, what my experience would tell me is this. So frequencies, you know, certainly if you want to know, you know, what the permeability of a material is below 100 megahertz, I think it's pretty well documented. Most of the time it's done through wire through the center. Are there other fixtures that are being used to look at what the permeabilities are above at very, very high frequencies, microwave frequencies and other things? Other techniques are used. And without getting into them too much, I'd rather stick to the wire turns through them because the ones that I know the most about, there are other methods and the how those fields and the permeability is actually measured. There's like what they call like field density measurements and other things. I understand them a little bit, but I, my practical experience is there. I could probably explain them, but there again, they're not a lot of measurements that I've made in the past. But I understand also that those measurements are more appropriate for higher frequencies. But there again, I don't know of too many people using coupling devices other than a few manufacturers, you know, in the gigahertz and above region. You know, but even for like 400 megahertz and below, I think you can still use wire and get the measurements that you need with turns, KC2QIQ.
You can say EY.
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree with you on that one. Mel, if you get a chance to go to the right website of that Glenn recommended to us last week, Magnetic Ink. I had a little bit of trouble finding Magnetic Inks because when I Googled those words, I found a zillion vendors of Magnetic Inks products. But when you finally get to the real Magnetic Inks website, they've got some beautiful tutorials that show you how to wrap turns of wire around your material and make a fairly simple inductance measurement at your desired frequency and come up with almost all the information you want. Over to you, Mel.
Okay. According to Zotto, which just goes the number of pages, it's quite an involved article he wrote here with a lot of mathematics and charts, drawings of different nomograms for testing and things like that. But he emphasizes that when he tested 10 different toroids of unknown nature that he didn't know in his system, he came out correct in each case. And they extended in frequencies way down from 7 megahertz up to 150 megahertz toroid cores. And when they were marked with him, without him knowing, you know, what the idea is, but it went later on was able to be he found he was accurate in all these cases just by putting him into the device stick over.
Now, do you believe that this cup that he's putting the toroid in is magnetically exciting the toroid material in a circumferential manner? Do you see methods by which it is creating magnetic fields around the racetrack, so to speak, of the toroid? Is that where the magnetic field was flowing during the measurement in this device? Back to you, Mel.
You know, as they say, one picture is worth a thousand words. If you can find the magazine, that you may see something very interesting because it's quite detailed what he wrote to tell Milton-W6RJO. And he shows he's got a test toroid in it on the bottom. And then he connects that to, let's see, how does he connect that? He connects that to, at that time, he was using a grid-dip meter with a communications receiver at the time, you know, going back to four frequency counters, I guess, were popular, to read the exact frequency, and then through a lot of mathematics here. Got pages and pages from there, but breaks it down into how you can really, exactly what the permeability is, and, according to the first, it's the Bureau of Standards, over.
Yeah, you got a little bit of trouble with that push-to-talk switch. Was the grid depth meter being put down the center of the toroid while the toroid is mounted in this cup? Is that the mechanism by which the grid depth meter was being coupled to the toroid material? Mel, go ahead.
No. The bottom of the cup has two contacts that come out of the bottom of the cup, which, in other words, you put the toroid in, you put the cover on, you're actually sealing it up inside this vessel, and then you are connecting through a coupling coil, the way I see it here, a coupling coil to the two contacts on the bottom of the cup, which is then picked up by the grid meter, Dick, over.
Okay, the coupling coil that's inside the cup, how does it couple its magnetic field into the sample of toroid material that you're about to measure?
The test cup inside there is a little shelf you put in there. What is the shelf made of? Let me see if I can see what the shelf is made of. Yeah, test toroid table. He calls it a table inside there. I don't know what it's made of. It's a plastic, I think, of some sort. I didn't go through the whole construction here. It's got a lot of detail on the construction. And you just sift the unknown toroid on top of this table and then close it and make the measurements over.
Mel, is anything running through the center of the toroid?
Just a stem of some sort. I believe it's a non-magnetic, but just to keep it in place. I think that's the lot to screw the cup, top of the cup down to. But, let's see, pop up stem. We've got a stem in here. What the heck is this stem made out of? Bushy stem. I'd have to read it over in detail, really, to see how he constructed this thing. Quite an article, if I could say, it runs about 10 pages over.
Would you be able to, somehow, email it to us?
No, okay.
I have no way of scanning this thing into you, unfortunately. Too bad. I think you'd love to see this thing. June 1977 ham radio. I didn't realize that you can't access that, Dick, over.
Yeah, somehow I thought we had access of those by way of the ARRL archives, but apparently the answer is no. I'll have to find that issue. But I can see where Glenn is going. If there isn't a conductive post going down the center of the toroid open area and completing some kind of a circuit around a ring that you... No, if you and I were putting a loop of wire around the toroid, you know the way we would loop the wire. And so if there isn't a conductive surface that somehow does that, I'm having trouble believing that the magnetic material is being excited in the right mode. Are you worried about the same thing I am, Glenn?
Yeah, precisely, Dick. It's a geometry issue. You know, you have cross-sectional area and you have path length. If you don't want to know what permeability is, the only ratio that permeability means anything is through the center. Anything around the outside is just undefined. So something has to determine what's going on through the center. So it's either some electrical wave is running through the middle, a conductor is running through the middle. Something has to go through the middle. And that will tell you what the permeability of that cross-sectional area and path length is. But, that's it in a nutshell. But just one other little piece of thing here, just to add, is that, you know, with materials, permeability is important, yes. But what makes a material proper for your application is the permeability at what the loss tangent is. So in other words, it's great to have high permeability, but you have to make sure that in your application that your loss tangent is low enough not to give you a problem. KC2, QIQ.
John is waiting with his question, and in the meantime, while Glenn is researching that modulation.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Can I just ask for that website one more time? Because I, or at least what was Googled, because I typed in vector space and I was missing something.
Space vector modulation Wikipedia. So you put space vector modulation, and you're going to get it.
Yeah. Once you're in Google, simply put space vector modulation plus wiki, and it's the first thing that comes up.
Got it. Thank you.
Somebody said something about toroids?
This is WA2EGT. Yes, I have a comment about the inductance index, A sub L, and determining that. Over.
Yes, start off with your name, and then ask your question to Glenn.
My name is Charlie. WA2EGT, and it's more of a comment than a question. It was about a year ago, and I was trying to determine the inductance index of some iron powder cores that I had. They were T50-2s and T50-6s, and I had them from various manufacturers. And what I discovered was you had to wind. You had to completely cover the toroid with windings. That is, put enough windings on the toroid to cover the total circumference of the core in order to accurately come up with the inductance index, A sub L. If you just used a few turns, just a few degrees of the circumference of the core, no matter what position the core was, the inductance index came up 50% off from what the manufacturer advertised. And I thought it was perhaps in the method that I was using. I have an Amidon Associates catalog, and they have many laboratory measurements of cores that they wound, and they have plotted here Q-curves. But what was so informative to me was they told you how many turns, what gauge of wire, what core it was, and what inductance they measured. And if it wasn't enough turns to cover the entire circumference of the core, then the inductance index could not be used. I don't know whether I'm making myself clear or not. I've been on before, Dick, and I am very nervous going on voice, and sometimes I become a little incoherent. So,
Leslie, clarify. This is WHUE. Don't worry, Charlie. You asked it very well. Do you remember if you only wound a few turns and didn't cover up the whole core, and you had this 50% error, were you getting too low or too high in inductance? I'm going to guess too low when the coil turns were not enough and not spaced out correctly. Is that roughly correct from your memory, Charlie?
Dick, that's a great question, and I don't have the answer. Unfortunately, I take core notes, and I've been going through my notes here. I don't have a quick answer for you. Over.
Can I answer this one, Dick?
Yeah, don't worry about how long it takes you to find that one, Charlie. And if you've got very high permeability material, where the magnetic field automatically concentrates itself in the toroid, my guess is there's no problem. But for very low permeability materials, where you now start getting a lot more leakage reactants into air, I am guessing this is more of a problem. Is that about the way you see it, Glenn?
Yes and no. Here's the complication. Keep in mind, A sub L and two inductance is N squared A sub L. So the less turns that you're getting, your inductance is falling off by the turns. Your inductance is falling off by turns squared. So now the next thing comes in is how accurate is your inductance bridge? And if you're starting off with a material that is already low permeability, like T52, which has got permeabilities of less than 50 or 60, somewhere in that area, well less than 100 for sure. And so now you've got a low permeability. You've got the N square problem because you've got very, very few turns. So at a very low permeability material, you may, because of the accuracy of your inductance bridge, may need almost to use the full single layers of turns to get enough turns. And another thing is, a T52 is not a very big toroid. Even if you're using a moderately small gauge of wire, like 20 gauge of wire, I doubt you can get even 100 turns on there with even like 20 gauge wire. So, you know, here again, you know, I said use a number like 100 turns, not necessarily 1,000. But a single layer of even 20 is going to be hard to get 60 turns on a single layer. KC2QIQ.
Is that A sub L term always with reference to inductance per 1,000 turns? And if I use 100 turns instead of 1,000, and I'm using an N squared, does that mean I get 1%? Let me think if I got that right. Yes. Does that mean with 100 turns I get 1% of the inductance I would have had with 1,000 turns? Over to you, Glenn.
Right on. You see the problem. And not only that, keep in mind, too, the unit is 10 to the minus 9th. So, in other words, what you're going to have, you have to multiply that by 10 to the 9th to get the correct inductance. It's because that measurement is in nanohenries.
And if I get down to a small enough number of nanohenries, I can only resonate that with a whopping big capacitor, or I have to go to a much higher frequency, both of which have got some problems. Is that what's going on?
Right on. I mean, there's definitely instrumentation out there. Like, HP has some bridges. Like, I've got one here. And, you can actually make some pretty interesting measurements with just a few turns and get pretty close to right on the money. But, you know, if you just take a, you know, like one of the cheapy inductance bridges and you take an inductance measurement with too few turns, those numbers are going to be all over the place because, you know, you need most of those inductance bridges, especially the inexpensive one, want to read millihenries. Microhenries, they're somewhat accurate, but, you know, once you get into small amounts of microhenries, the accuracy start going way out. So, so a lot of it's instrumentation and an N-square problem, KC2QIQ.
I have a genius method of measuring permeability very accurately.
And how are you going to do that, Wesley?
I'm going to take my 5 inches fairway drink, drop it to Glen Place, and I'm going to know everything about it. And to exit.
That's an approach. John, either you or Wesley bought some really potent neodymium magnets recently, and I think I heard you one day describe the fact that when two of them stuck together and your finger was in the way, you ended up with a great big injury to your finger. What manufacturer did you buy those neodymium magnets from, and roughly how expensive were they for what kind? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the SecNet.
Which magnet?
KC2WGB. Dick, I don't know the manufacturer, but I bought a lot of 20. They're the size of a quarter, just about as thick and the same diameter. And they are so powerful, I cannot believe it. I also bought ones shaped like a cube, and they're also powerful, but they're only about a half inch long and about a quarter inch square. Very effective and very good magnets. And I held two of them about 5 inches apart, and I let one go. It slammed into the other magnet and just shattered, unbelievable, into little tiny pieces. It was incredible to see that. And I have another question when we get off this subject.
Did you buy them from eBay or something like that? Is that why you don't know where they came from?
Exactly. I got them on eBay. They were dirt cheap, and I think it was even free shipping. And they came from, I believe it was China. It could have been Taiwan, but basically the same. But very inexpensive and lovely to play with. I'm going to buy a lot more of them.
Is that the eBay site, one of these sites that's continuously selling those, or did you buy the whole lot? Go ahead.
Oh, negative. There's plenty more available, and you can buy them in groups of 10. Like I said, for $5.25, I think they are. It doesn't really matter what size you buy. They seem to be basically the same price. I'm looking to try to get ones larger for other experiments, but you'll be thrilled when you get them, how effective you can use them.
Hey, you got to be careful. Those things are dangerous. And even the little bitty ones, if they ever get swaddled by a child, terrible things can happen. Go ahead with your next question, John.
Okay, don't laugh at me. I'm looking to buy an electron microscope. I'd like to know your opinion and your experience, if you have, what I should be concerned about and what should I look for.
When it comes to ordinary optical microscopes, I use them every day of my life for the last 10 years. I've got lots of opinion on those. Never in my life have I even been in the same room with an electron microscope. So I got no knowledge on that. Are you fairly sure that you need something that exotic to get down to that level, John, that you don't think a high-quality stereo zoom optical microscope with the right kind of fiber optic lighting, you don't think that's going to satisfy your need? Over to you, John.
No, I had a lot of those lights, and I had a couple of Icon with the camera company. I've had a few of those, to Nikon. I've had a few of those. The German ones were better, but they really don't get... I've been in rooms with them. I've used electron microscopes, but they were fairly modern. The ones that are available for like between 5 and 9,000 are a little older. They're quite large. They're console pieces, but I just thought maybe you had some experience with it and what to look out for. So, okay. So you can't help me on that one, but maybe Glenn has experience with them.
How about a scanning tunnel microscope?
I don't really know what that is, Eric.
There's
Bye to Joe Merrick.
Well, those you can literally build. They're invented up at MIT. They actually have more resolution than an electron microscope, just smaller, and I don't need as much support gear around it.
Does the specimen have to be conductive? In the case of an electron microscope, I think you've got to spray the specimen with something that's conductive, and it operates in a vacuum. Are both of those needs required for a scanning tunneling microscope? Go ahead.
Yeah, if you Google scanning tunnel microscope, you get a whole bunch of interesting stuff. It's more powerful, and there's less to it.
I think I've seen pictures with a scanning tunneling microscope where they literally show you the bumps of a surface where you're resolving individual atoms or molecules of the material that's being scanned. Is that your recollection also, Eric?
Yes, it is, and you can actually zoom out.
Tell me about zoom out. Is that an electronic zoom? In other words, after you've scanned and gathered all the data, now you can display it in various ways? Is that what's really happening? Or are you now using a duller probe and getting a lower resolution picture over a larger area? Over to you, Eric.
Question two.
Scanning a larger area, and the way it, you know, you're resolving the picture in terms of how many pixels of the display you're operating with. So you have the ability to scan molecules or to scan thousands of molecules.
Okay, John and Glenn in that area. Go ahead, John. that order. You got it, John.
Eric, is that also X-ray driven?
I'm not absolutely sure. It's been a bunch of years since I had an interest in it, so give me a minute and I'll look it up.
I think the way it works is you put a small potential on the probe with reference to the material being scanned, and I think you're then measuring the tunneling current that occurs between the probe and the material as the probe is being raised and lowered as it goes across the material. As you go across the material, you're raising and lowering the probe to keep the tunneling current constant, and you're recording the amount of raising and lowering of the probe, and recording that in nanometers, I guess, and that is therefore allowing you to make the, what am I going to call it now? It's a landscape picture you're getting, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I understand what you're saying. It's so interesting, and when you see them work, the amount of resolution they can get from them is just amazing. And the algorithms that they use to recreate these pictures, I don't know how that's done, but that's probably another process that would be very interesting. I believe Glenn had a question.
Yeah, your description is basically right. The scanning tunneling microscope head uses a platinum iridium stylus. The tip is moved across the sample in an XY plane, changes the surface height and density, causes a change in current. The changes are then mapped in images.
So, are they plotting the change in current, or are they plotting the change in the position of the probe, height of the probe, that creates a constant current? I wonder if you've got a guess on that one, Eric.
Okay, the scanning creates the XY, and the tunneling current creates the image. The resolution of an image is limited by the radius of curvature of the scanning tip of the scanning tunneling microscope. Image artifacts can occur if the tip has two tips at the end rather than a single atom, leaving to, now you can read this all stuff. And it says recently carbon nanotubes have been used. I gotta read a little more. But it's an interesting device, and it's different than an electron microscope.
You make it sound like you get more bang for the dollar out of the scanning tunneling than you do with an electron microscope. Is that true?
I believe so. From one of the things when I remember hearing about it the first time, and talking to my friends up at MIT, it was like, a fraction of the cost of an electron microscope.
However, if the material you want to scan is a three-dimensional object, like an insect, I don't think you could do that with a scanning tunneling microscope. Well, I suspect you're right about that. Go ahead, Glenn.
I guess my question is really for John. I'm kind of interested in what it is that he wants to look at with an electron microscope. I mean, I did it at, used one at the university level, and I can just tell you, it's really looking at very, very small things. And my only experience of working with it was I wasn't even the operator. I was just, among the group. And let's just say that, four of us spent maybe a half an hour to talk about what we were going to look at. And then we saw something, and then there was about 2 hours of discussion after that to what we were actually viewing. But I was just wondering from John, his experience with it, or what he's hoping to experience with an electronic microscope. John, what's your target? What are you trying to look at? I mean, an electron microscope is like, you know, some people look at very, very small things. KC2, QIQ.
Yes, Glenn, it sure is. I'm looking to look at the stress on the extreme fibers of such structures as film strip and also wires, copper wire and silver wire. That's basically what I'm looking for.
John, I would just say I think you can get more bang with your buck with a regular optical stereoscopic with the right magnification, because I think with an electron microscope, that's, you may not even get to the point of seeing what you want to see. KC2, QIQ.
KC2, KEY, got a comment.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, a friend of mine had one. I think it was built by RCA, an old one. I think he broke it up. I'm sure by now it's all gone. It used what they call electrostatic electron microscope. Had a magnification range from 100,000 to 500,000. And it was a big piece of machinery. It was a console, but a big piece of equipment. I hope you realize this thing, to move it was quite a project, over.
Yeah, John, do you think you're going to be making enough measurements that ownership is required as opposed to going to a center somewhere that has this capability? Over to you, John.
Well, only because it's more convenient for me to have it where I can use it at my own time, where you have to structure appointments, and then basically a lot of the places don't allow you to operate it. They operate it for you, and you have to write up a program for them. But answer to Glenn, I've tried the optical microscopes, and some of them very expensive, very large ones. They didn't do what I was looking for. But I know the RCA one that you're talking about, Mel, that's an old one. I think it was like 1968. It was a big cylinder that sat on top of the console, and the cylinder was about 4 feet or 5 feet high. Is that the one you saw?
And to expand with a comment?
You got it, Mel?
It's Wesley.
Mel, you got it first, then Wesley second. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, yeah, that's the one, the RCA with the vacuum pump. And the power supply, I think it was a 50,000-volt power supply on that thing. It was exactly the way you described it, with a console, with this thing sitting on top of it. And I don't know how the heck he even got it there. It was in the garage, laying there for years. Got it for nothing, of course. I think he broke it up and got rid of it. I'm 99% sure a couple of years ago he said he's going to clean it out. And he said, "You want anything off of it?" And I said, "Nah, not really." So I guess it went to the junk pile. But that's the one, the RCA, with all the contraptions, over.
Wesley would want the power supply, that I can guarantee you.
Mel, the buddy of yours who had this thing, did he ever put it in operating mode in his QTH, or is it something that somebody gave away and he acquired it but never got a chance to use it? Over to you, Mel.
But he never used it. He just had a big collection of junk every time. I mean, worse than I am. I mean, possibility was offered to me, I would be dragging it some way or another. But, he has stuff. You know, they cleaned out these labs, and there's so much stuff went out. He just stuck it in the garage with a ton of other stuff, and that's it. Nah, he never hooked it up, but it was working. He said it was working before he took it over.
Interesting. You got it, Wesley.
Yeah. So there's always a prediction that the electron microscope is supposed to be very expensive. Of course they are, a few million dollars. But I have made 106 purchases so far on eBay, and probably another 40 or 50 of eBay within 3 months period of time. And I found out one thing. If you really want it, you can get it. There are two offers right now. One is for $2,999, and this is the Tarpon electron microscope, and the other one is Hitachi scanning electron microscope for $2,675.
Like this. So you've made 100 and some odd purchases on eBay and another 50 by other means. Well, you guys are getting serious. Over to you, Wesley.
Yeah, it's about 3 months ago when I actually started to complete my lab. Maybe 4. So, no, not even. So, yes, 106 purchases on eBay, another close to 50, maybe even more than 50, of eBay. Yes, I am very serious. As I said, the reason for it is because I saw it on my own eye, and there is no way in the whole world that 2.75 watts could burn 150 watts, unless you give me an answer, you know. I know it works, and to XGN.
No, I don't stand a chance of giving an answer on that one. And you saw that in your own location with your own material, and I think Eric saw at least the hardware that was capable of doing that, and I guess he made a suggestion of making some improvements of repeatability, and that's how some of this got started. Eric, you have caused, by some of your comments, Eric, I think you've caused quite a bit of hardware to be purchased and placed into Queens. K2EJ for any comment on that, K2RIW.
Improving the economy.
T2QIQ with a comment.
You got it, Glenn. I'm waiting for the repeater to drop.
Rick first.
But it's going to time out on it. I'm just looking at eBay here. Boy, is this getting electron microscopes for $6,000 and for $62,000 and $2,000. There's a lot of stuff here. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I was thinking more along the... He needed to see something molecular in size, and that's why the scanning tunnel microscope would be, tunneling microscope would be the real object, not an electron microscope. But, oh well, if you got money, go spend it.
If you weren't such a penny pincher, you would own some of this stuff. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I'd just like to offer an opinion. I know the stuff that, you know, and the size that you're looking at, John, and I was going to offer another solution. They sell little lab cameras. They're video cameras that you can basically plug into a USB port on your computer. And with a nice 24-inch screen on your computer, you can actually get little like optics fittings for the end of the little digital camera that can go right into the end of an optical microscope. And they make some beautiful optical microscopes. And you can focus in and you can observe your target on a nice 21 or 25-inch screen on your computer, and again, you can copy, and you can print out, and you can do beautiful things, and you'd be amazed at what you can see with that. And to look at things like copper fragments and ends and little, you know, structure fractures and things at that level, I don't think you need an electron microscope. You know, it might be a lot of money, and then at the end, what you could really do with a digital camera and a PC and a nice big monitor might be superior. KC2QIQ.
And scanning tunneling microscopes on eBay is like $900 and $500, and that's weird.
Those are real nice numbers. Okay, we're approaching the bewitching hour. I'm going to be saying 73 to you guys. You just listened to TechNet number 1320 of the series that began in September of 1982, 26 years ago. I got that right? Wait a minute now. 28 years ago. 28 years ago. 28 years and 1 month ago. Be kind to each other. 73. We'll be back next week, as long as we all stay healthy. And Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
I say amen to staying healthy. Had my share of it last week or so. And as Dick says, we'll do it again. Thank you for all the good wishes. And we'll try to pick up as many emails of interest and listen for them next week. 73 to all. Have a great week. This is K2KEY saying goodnight to you guys.
Good night, Dick. Good night, Mel. Great talking to you guys. Wonderful night.
So thanks, guys, and don't forget, Dick, next week, space vector modulation. Have a good night, guys. Thank you very much, all of you. If I list you, all of you, I probably will forget to list a few others that were listening as well. Enter XM.
Yeah, 73 is Dick. 73 is Mel. Glad to hear you back on again. Okay, everybody, have a good week. KC2, QIQ.
Ryan, take care.
Good night to you all, and listen on the input. Hey, too, Jay.
Eric.
That's what I've been doing, Eric.
We'll figure this out at some point.
Eric, by the way, I haven't heard the Intimod. Do you still have that PL turned off?
Yeah, the Intimod's still there. It's just it doesn't hang when you drop, so... it still leaves people intelligible when they're transmitting. But I haven't had a chance to go up to the repeater and make some changes. Because I can make the PL drop when the transmission breaks and hopefully prevent it from carrying itself on. But there's going to be some changes made up at the site. It's just a matter of we have to be patient and wait for that to happen. And hopefully the Intimod will just go away and I can turn the output PL back on.
Oh, sounds like a working plan. Well, wish you a lot of luck with that, and I applaud you for your efforts. Thank you. KC2WGB, have a great evening, Eric.
Yeah, and Eric, yes, I should be thankful the most to you, because you're the guy who is actually pushing me in the right direction. Yeah. Because of conversation with you and because of your presence, I did make quite good few purchases. I was going in the right direction.
Link clear.
All right, you guys. Have a good evening. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Okay, you too, guys.
John, another good night.
KC2QIQ, this is WA2EGT. WA2EGT, KC2QIQ.
Hi, Glenn. Glenn, the call here is Whiskey Alpha 2 Echo Golf Tango. The name is Charlie. Glenn, not to keep you up too late as it is, I just wanted to thank you for your contribution to the net. I sure appreciate that. A number of very knowledgeable people here. I just wanted to answer your comments. I'm measuring the inductance, not using toys. I'm using lab-grade test equipment. Granted, it's old. I have a Tektronix 130 LC meter. And an S30 calibrator, and I went through a calibration procedure with it, and I also have an HP4342Q meter, and I can measure inductance with that, and I would bounce one measurement off the other, and there was a great correlation between the two of them. And the inductance that I was measuring, the lowest value was 500 nanohenries, which this instrumentation is more than capable of measuring. And I was very puzzled by this phenomenon. So I was always the understanding that it didn't matter how much of the toroid was covered with turn, that the inductance in them always applied. But there was always tweaking involved in projects. And then after all these years, and then doing this experiment was a revelation. Plus, what I had observed is also reflected in the data in lab measurements from Amidon Associates. They had cores where they did not cover the entire core, and they
inductance.